Support for WPR comes from the American Society of Landscape Architects Wisconsin Chapter. Dedicated to reimagining the design of outdoor spaces for the well-being of all. Examples at wiasla.com.
Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences. Itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Morality is what matters to me. It's being a good person. And when you put forward a religion that says belief in Christ alone saves and has nothing to do with morality, well, to me, that's immoral.
That's Anne Rice, queen of the vampire novel and a devout Christian, at least until her very public defection from the Catholic Church. She's part of a growing movement of believers who no longer want to be a part of any church.
But, you know, when you look at polls, 91 or 92% still say they believe in God. But people are unwilling to even refer to it as religiosity any longer.
Today, searching for the sacred in a post-religious age. Also, the spiritual lives of atheists and why some are sick of hearing non-believers like Richard Dawkins bash religion.
I actually think that people like Dawkins do enormous disservice. And I also would argue, like, who said that they spoke for science? Who elected them as the representatives of science in this issue?
You might call Alain de Botton the people's philosopher. He's written a series of best-selling books that play with big ideas, which he makes both fun and thought-provoking. So it's not surprising he finally got around to one of the biggest ideas of them all, religion. The twist is that de Botton is an atheist, but he thinks non-believers have plenty to learn from religious traditions. He calls his new book Religion for Atheists. De Botton tells Anne Strangechamps that he had to overcome his own hostility to religion.
I realized that it simply couldn't be as simple as saying that everything to do with religion was nonsense, which was how I'd been brought up. And I came to make a distinction, basic distinction, but it took a while for me to get there, between non-belief, in other words, thinking that the doctrines of religion, the supernatural doctrines of religion, might not be true, and an interest in religion as a sociological, organizational, and aesthetic phenomenon. And I realized that it was possible to be interested in religion, to engage with religion, to borrow many concepts and attitudes and structures and rituals without necessarily subscribing to any supernatural tenets.
What does that mean to you exactly, to be involved with religion's sociological and aesthetic dimensions without ascribing to its tenets?
Sure, let me give you a very basic example. You can go and sing Christmas carols and enjoy Christmas carols without necessarily believing that Jesus was the Son of God and ascended to heaven. Now, for a Christian, that's deeply offensive. And the thought is, well, come on, you can't enjoy the carols and the community and the singing and the art and the church and the candles unless you also believe in the resurrection. But in fact, it's completely possible.
So I'm getting the sense that you found yourself longing for some of the sociological dimensions, the aesthetic dimensions of religion. Well, for example, the opening essay in this new book is an analysis of, I guess, what you could call the psychology of the Catholic Mass, which, first of all, Mass is kind of an odd habitat for an atheist. How many have you attended?
Oh, quite a few by now. My method was to say, what are some of the things in religion that would appeal to an atheist, that appeal to me? And I just went around deliberately picking and mixing from a variety of religions in order to ask a very basic question, which is, what can we learn from here? What can we, if you like, steal from here that might be of use in a secular life? So I went along to some Catholic masses and was impressed really by the atmosphere of community that is created by the church on a Sunday via the Mass, which seems so at odds with the anonymity of so much of the modern world, where you just don't talk to strangers, you don't meet other people. You certainly are never brought into contact with people at such a sort of profound spiritual level. I mean, what the church does, it demarcates a space and says everybody can meet everyone. Everyone is safe to talk to. And it's a very simple gesture. It doesn't really require a belief in the supernatural, but it requires somebody to do it.
So as a result, you've proposed a kind of secular alternative a communal meal experience that, I mean, a fictional, that you call the Agape Restaurant. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, well, I tried to imagine, what might an atheist take away from this? How could we put something of this back into the secular world? And it struck me that all organized religions have a tradition of eating together, communal eating. And in fact, Holy Communion, before it was a church service, was a shared meal, what was called an agape feast, where Christians would, in early Christian communities, would gather together to break bread and invite strangers into their midst. It's a charming idea. Where do we have anything like that today? Nowhere. You know, the average modern restaurant or diner or bar, it's an anonymous place. There are people, but it's an anonymous place. So I imagined being inspired by this tradition of religious communal eating, and that atheists too might learn to eat together, might learn to structure their encounters with one another around a table without just saying, you know, what do you do, but to get to some of the same vulnerable material as religious communities know how to address.
It sounds like part of what you think religion does well has to do with the psychology of a community. You also write about Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement, which you describe as one of the most psychologically effective mechanisms ever devised for resolving social conflict. What do you mean?
That's right. I mean, religions seem to know both what we want from communities and also what makes living in a community difficult. And one of the things that makes other people difficult is that we're full of resentments against them and we get into fights with them, and then we don't know how to get out of those fights. We don't know how to forgive. We don't know how to heal divisions between people. And Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, is a fascinating ritual where the entire Jewish community essentially says sorry to one another and accepts the apologies of others under the guidance of God. And it's a sort of miraculous day that does that very important thing, which is to enable people to move on from disputes. As I say, that's something that generally we feel rather at a loss as to know how to do that without some help. You see, a lot of what religions do, a lot of what religious rituals are, is communal forms of behavior that help you to do something that's very hard to do just on your own. You could look at a lot of what religions do as lending structure to important psychological events.
Mm. So what else would you like to steal from religion for atheism? We've been talking about the kind of rituals and communal values. What about art, music?
Yes, well, I think one of the things that religions know is that if you're trying to influence somebody, if you're trying to have an impact on somebody's life, if you do it simply through intellectual discussion and argument, you're not going to get very far. So all religions employ other means. They touch us through our senses. They give us songs to sing. They tell us to sit in certain ways. They put pictures in front of our eyes. They build buildings. In other words, they use our senses to pull us in certain, what they think of as optimal directions. You see, religions tell us things like, you know, you've got to love one another, you've got to forgive one another. But that can sound awfully trite and boring. But if you come across a great work of art, a great film, a great piece of music, you know, you can listen to a Bach cantata and suddenly think, oh goodness, that's what forgiveness is. You know, I'd forgotten it. It had gone a bit stale in my imagination, but it's now come back to life.
What would atheist art look like then, or atheist-inspired art, or great art in the service of atheism?
Well, atheists have lots of art. We don't need more art. I think it's just about the way you frame art. Let me give you an example of the American artist Mark Rothko. See, Rothko wanted to change the world. Rothko wanted to see his paintings, in his own words, as an echo chamber of humanity's grief. So in other words, this was a kind of form of public consolation, if you like. Now, you would never pick that up from the captions in an average museum. You just think Rothko is a terribly intimidating and slightly ambiguous and strange, very famous American artist. But a museum, the way I'd like to do a museum, would actually bring that out. It would tease that didactic side of Rothko, or indeed any artist. Most artists want to change the world in some way. It's just you wouldn't really know it from the average museum presentation. Museums are, on the whole, very neutral. They're white, they're bland, and compare that with the way that religions use art. Religions, as I say, use art in these very direct, emotional ways. You know, you might cry in front of a picture. You might change your life because of a picture.
Can you imagine a kind of secular temple in which Rothko's paintings maybe were centerpieces? How would you approach them instead?
Well, you know, of course, that there is such a thing in Texas. There is precisely the Rothko Chapel and its most wonderful space. It's precisely that. It's a non-denominational, contemplative, rather melancholy but amazing place where people will go and take time out from their busy lives and get in touch with their deeper selves, not in order to commune with God, as you might in a traditional chapel, but in order to commune with those more elusive, shy, but important sides of ourselves, what you might call the deep self, you know, that isn't there at the dinner table and gets squashed at the office, but, you know, has a chance to come out. And, you know, we're still at the dawn of learning how to live well without religion, you know, one of the first few generations to do that. Religions have always known that putting people in a certain space can heavily influence what goes on in their minds. You can have calm spaces that will bring calm. You can have spaces that are huge and will bring a feeling of perspective. So all of these things religious buildings can do, and there's no fundamental reason why non-believers shouldn't benefit from some of these wonderful maneuvers of religious architecture down the centuries. You know, people will say, well, you know, what about the library? Or what about the observatory? Haven't we got these buildings already? And I would say, well, it's slightly different from the genuinely spiritual, if you like, psychological focus of religious buildings.
Alain de Botton talked with Anne Strainchamps. His book is called Religion for Atheists, A Non-Believer's Guide to the Uses of Religion. Astrophysicist Adam Frank is another atheist with a spiritual bent, although in his case, his yearning for the sacred is rooted in science. Frank's the author of The Constant Fire, Beyond the Science versus Religion Debate. He calls himself an unapologetic disciple of the path and practice of science. But he also gets impatient with the way many scientists sneer at any talk of spirituality. And he remains open to some ideas that atheists tend to dismiss out of hand. For instance, the possibility that consciousness could survive death. Frank tells Steve Paulson that his fascination with the sacred goes back to his childhood.
When I was a kid and I first began to learn about science, some of my deepest, most profound experiences, really life-altering, life-shaping experiences, came through the lens of science. So, well, you know, when I was very young, one of the things that set me on the path of science, it was a summer's day and the thunder is booming and lightning is, you know, flashing in the sky, and I'm terrified, of course. And my father says, well, you know, you don't really need to be worried too much about that because here's what thunder and lightning is. And he gave me this beautiful, cogent explanation. And it just opened my eyes. I mean, not only did it not, you know, sort of make me less fearful, but more than that, I suddenly had this experience of seeing, you know, the air being shattered by the lightning bolt and then the air rushing back in to create the shockwave and the thunder. And moments like that have tracked with me, you know, through my entire life. And each one, as I learned more about spiritual experiences, how people describe religious experiences, I had to say, like, well, you know, that clearly what I was having could be described as a religious experience. There's no idea of God in it. There's no supernatural being. But the expanse of the oceanic feeling, as Freud would call it, was clearly part of it. And it has changed my life.
That's fascinating. So somehow understanding how the world works, I mean, how nature works, you're saying that transports you in a spiritual way.
I believe it does. And I think, you know, this is a very common experience for people, both scientists and non-scientists. And then what we do is we tell people when they say, oh, wow, I had a spiritual experience. We say, oh, no, you didn't. No, that has nothing to do with spirituality. And I think it's a grave mistake because we sort of cut off this wellspring of human emotion, of the human experience of the sacred, as I call it.
So part of the problem, as you see it, is the words that we use. And my sense is that you don't much like the word religion and all that it suggests. I mean, doctrine and theology and all of that. But you are more comfortable using words like spiritual or the sacred.
Yes. I mean, obviously, spirituality is a word people use. There's that tag of spiritual but not religious. But in my research, I stumbled upon the word sacred. And what I loved about the word sacred is that its roots don't connect to any religion. Any existing religion, unless, of course, you're a pagan, because it was about Roman temple architecture. The sacer was the interior domain of Roman temples. And in the sacer, you really needed to be attentive. And that word is really a key, attention. You needed to be attentive to the needs of the gods. And outside in the profanum, you could do whatever you wanted. You could sell your Grateful Dead t-shirts. You could sell walnuts. So the sacred is that experience we have when we pay attention to the world in a very special way.
Well, you've written some really interesting things about how you interpret, some of the great spiritual teachers, I guess you could say. For instance, you've written about the Buddha, the Catholic mystic Teresa of Avila, and you say there is some truth discovered that is more than simple neurochemistry gone amok. And it's an interesting position to stake out because it's a place where a lot of atheists don't want to go, to say that spiritual experience cannot be reduced to brain chemistry.
Yeah, because my point has always been that you can hook me up to a machine and identify which parts of my brain light up when I eat an apple, but that will never actually reach my experience of the apple. I mean, a thought is a very strange thing. Where is my thought, right? You know, the neural correlate, as they call that, of which part of the brain lights up when I have a thought is not my thought. Right? Those are electrons moving around. My experience of my thoughts is a very different entity. And we are so far from a theory of consciousness that I think it's very premature to be making grand pronouncements about what consciousness is and how it relates to the brain.
Well, this raises fascinating questions about all kinds of issues. And you wrote a column not that long ago on your NPR blog about life after death. And you said that you remain fully and firmly agnostic on the question of whether consciousness exists after death. And I have to say, this is not the usual atheist position to take.
Right. And I got into a lot of trouble with people for doing that. But really, I mean, you know, hey, I'm a scientist and you got no data, right? If you have no data about what happens after death, then it's probably a much better idea to say, I don't know. I mean, you know, let's put our cards on the table. I'm not saying that there is life after death. And, you know, the idea of a soul, of a transpersonal soul that rises, I mean, also that doesn't make very much sense to me either. But certainly what I'm saying is I don't have any information about this phenomena of what happens after death.
But you got a lot of flack from some people. I mean, for instance, your fellow physicist, Sean Carroll, who said that he's an outspoken atheist. He said that believing in the possibility of life after death is the equivalent of believing the moon is made of green cheese.
Right, right. I love Sean. He's great. We have wonderful debates. Let me be clear. I am not arguing that there is life after death. I really don't know. And you know, who knows what form it could take if there was. It's not life after death. One quite way to phrase this is consciousness local or not? Is consciousness embedded in your head and that's it? Right. You know, William James, a long time ago, when he was thinking about consciousness, he said, well, you know, consciousness could be related to circuitry in your brain or it could be that your brain's like a radio. You know, is tuned to consciousness. What I'm saying is it's a little strident to be taking a militant position on this when you have zero data.
Well, it seems to me you've just laid out the two competing visions of atheism. There's the hardcore version of people like Sean Carroll and Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett who don't like any talk about spirituality and frankly don't like the word mystery. They consider this fuzzy thinking. And then there is your position, and there are others like you who I guess I would classify you as falling into the spiritual atheism camp who are trying to formulate an understanding of the sacred without resorting to anything supernatural. Is that a fair distinction?
That is a very fair distinction. I actually think that like people like Dawkins do enormous disservice. And I also, you know, would argue like who said that they spoke for science? Who elected them as the representatives of science in this issue? If you go back and look at scientists themselves, many of them held deeply spiritual positions. You know, they came to their own experience of science. They had what they would describe as rich spiritual lives.
Tell me about some of these people.
Well, I mean, in some cases, they were explicitly religious, right? Like Isaac Newton. I mean, the interesting thing about Isaac Newton that really has only been recognized in the last, you know, 50 or 60 years is that this guy wrote more about religion than he did about physics.
Yeah, and he loved alchemy, of course.
Right, right, which he saw as sort of those, you know, were intertwined. His spiritual questions, his religious questions were entwined with his alchemy. He considered himself a priest of nature. And then there's James Maxwell Clerk, who, you know, invented the equations, the beautiful equations that describe all electromagnetic phenomena, as well as a lot of other things. And he was, you know, a very solid Protestant. And then you get to Einstein. You know, I think Einstein you have to put in this category of spiritual atheist. You know, I mean, there's so many quotes from him. He talks about people. He rails against the atheists who are so strident in their positions. He says those are people who don't believe in mystery, he says, are like snuffed out candles. Or another, actually, a fascinating example is Wolfgang Pauli, who is considered one of the greatest European physicists, or greatest physicists of the last century, one of the founders of quantum mechanics. And the interesting, really interesting story about Pauli is that, you know, from the outside, he looked like the, you know, quintessential Germanic physicist. He was a theorist of the highest caliber, you know, was absolutely condescending to you if your mathematics was wrong. He's the guy who invented not even wrong. You know, somebody was giving a talk one time and he said, "Sir, your theory is not even wrong." You know? That's the ultimate insult in physics. But he had had a very difficult life as a young man, and he was having these dreams that were just stunning in their vividness and their richness of their metaphors. And he actually ended up with Jung. He ended up doing psychotherapy with Jung. And the two of them started a conversation through their letters for the rest of their lives. And Pauli really became a Jungian, started thinking deeply about the collective unconscious, started thinking deeply about how dreams become metaphors for both physics and for life. So, I mean, I think it's really wrong to sort of say science equals this sort of hyper-strident atheism.
Well, my sense is that there is now a sort of a nascent but starting to grow movement among secular scientists, philosophers, naturalists who are trying to formulate a new kind of spirituality without any reference to the supernatural. You would seem to be part of that. And first of all, do you see that happening? And if so, do you see this as a significant movement?
Yes, I absolutely see it happening. I think it's fascinating. It's just in time. When you say science and religion to people, the first thing they think of is like Richard Dawkins arguing with a Southern evangelicist about evolution, right? And it's like, oh my God, that has happened for so long and it just sucks all the air out of the room. You know, there's absolutely nothing interesting is going to happen in that debate. And then there's scientists who look at this and just see this going back and forth. They're like, oh God, I've had it. You know, I just do not want to be part of this debate. As much as horrified as we are by having, you know, Republican presidential candidates stand up and say that evolution isn't happening. But when it comes to sort of thinking about this issue, scientists who sort of have their own experiences of what I would call the spiritual, it's a non-supernatural spiritual, are trying to say, what kind of questions can we ask? What is the right question to ask? What's the right approach where really we might learn something about this?
Adam Frank is an astrophysicist at the University of Rochester and one of the founders of the NPR science blog 13.7. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, The Constant Fire, Beyond the Science versus Religion Debate.
The answers are here. The answers are here. The wisdom of centuries, Aristotle, Maxwell, Einstein.
Does the idea of spiritual atheism resonate for you? You can share your thoughts by emailing our website at ttbook.org or by commenting on our Facebook page. Coming up, best-selling novelist Anne Rice explains why she broke with the Catholic Church. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. A couple of years ago, novelist Anne Rice posted a note on her Facebook page announcing, "Today I quit being a Christian." She went on to say, "I refuse to be anti-artificial birth control. I refuse to be anti-democrat. I refuse to be anti-secular humanism. I refuse to be anti-science. In the name of Christ, I quit Christianity and being Christian." Well, that statement came as quite a shock to the millions of fans who'd followed her career, first as the queen of vampire fiction, author of the best-selling Vampire Chronicles, and later as a convert to Catholicism and author of a series celebrating the life of Jesus. But the story's even more complicated, as Rice tells Anne Strangechamps. For years, she'd been a staunch atheist, but only after growing up a devout Catholic in New Orleans.
Everybody went to Catholic school. We didn't even know anybody that went to public school. And we went to Mass and Communion every morning from the age of 6 on, really. And it was a Catholic world. You didn't go see a movie if the Archbishop condemned the movie.
Then you lost your faith after a series of personal tragedies and some horrific deaths in your family.
Well, not really. I lost it on a college campus at 18, really for the same reason many college kids do. because I wanted to know what the world was about. I wanted to read Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus and Kierkegaard and figure out what existentialism was and what the Beat Generation was. That's why I lost it. I felt that it was not a valid description of the way the world was, and it couldn't be true as a religion.
Was there a moment when you thought, I'm an atheist, I don't believe anymore?
Yes. Definitely. And for years, I did consider myself an atheist. In fact, for a very long time, 38 years, until I finally gave that up in a moment of realizing that I believed in God and I wanted to go back to religion.
Which shocked everybody at the time. I mean, you'd been writing the Vampire Chronicles for years. I mean, there was, what was it, some Christian commentator said it was like the conversion of St. Augustine, you know, this daughter of darkness had returned to the light.
Well, that may prove to have been an exaggeration.
What happened? Why did you rejoin the church?
My conversion was really a conversion to believing in God. And it was very natural to me to go home to the Catholic Church, to that beautiful ritual of Holy Communion at Mass, to talk to God. I wanted to go back to the banquet table. And I thought the Catholic religion, whatever differences I had with it, God was merciful. God knew the answers. God wasn't going to send people to hell by mistake. He, you know, I didn't have to worry about the policies or the fire and brimstone sermons of Christians. And I came after a while to realize that I was in bed with people that I had nothing in common with and certainly didn't agree with on almost anything. Well, let's put it this way. I'm very aware that what Jesus means to me is not what he means to many, many other Christians.
What's the difference?
Well, I would say that I was in love with the Jesus of the Sermon on the Mount and the Lord's Prayer, the Jesus of the Good Samaritan parable and the Prodigal Son parable. But that is only one Jesus. When you really study the entire Bible, you see that there is quite another way to view Jesus that's more in keeping with the book of Revelation and more in keeping with other passages in the Bible where he speaks of people going into everlasting darkness or fire and where there's the gnashing of teeth. I mean, there's another side of Jesus, and that side has had a very distinct history in the history of Christianity. It's Jesus, the divine terminator, as Philip Zuckerman called him, who's going to come back at the end to hurl most of humanity into the lake of fire. And that's the Jesus I don't believe in, and I came to realize that I couldn't.
When you publicly announced a few years ago that you were leaving the Catholic Church, you know, that was stunning to a lot of people who had watched your kind of religious trajectory. Mm-hmm. What you said at the time, or at least what got reported in the press, was that you could not continue to be part of a church that didn't support the civic rights of gay people, that didn't support the reproductive rights of women. It sounded more as though your main problems with the Catholic Church had to do with politics, not so much with theology.
Well, I actually made a more thorough statement. I said I refused to be anti-gay, anti-feminist, anti-evolution, anti-science. And I really meant those statements to have deep theological roots. But it was certainly the political and social pressure that pushed me to make a public statement. You know, you can live with theological differences, but it was the tremendous pressure I felt due to the actions of the Catholic bishops in America and the things that they did politically and socially that I really do not believe in at all. And I had many, many differences with my Protestant brothers and sisters as well over what they believed. I really think that, how shall I put it? I mean, morality is what matters to me. It's being a good person. And when you put forward a religion that says that belief in Christ alone saves and has nothing to do with morality, well, to me, that's immoral. And I can't believe that God is immoral. And so I don't believe he's going to send Anne Frank and the Dalai Lama and Gandhi to hell because they don't believe in Jesus.
Well, I'm curious because I think that your feelings reflect a much larger current today, which is that what you could call the deinstitutionalization of faith. You know, some people talk about
yes.
Christianity after religion. Can there be such a thing, Christianity without the church?
Oh, absolutely. And I think you put it very well there. That's exactly what it's about. I got an enormous amount of email as a result of what happened. And also, stories were written about it all over the world. I was amazed. You know, I saw headlines in German saying, you know, that Anne Rice has quit Christianity. And I thought, what in the world? Why are they interested in this in Berlin?
For having poster said? Child for the apostates.
Well, no, but the reason these stories were written was not because I was so well-known or what I did was so unusual. They were written because people were talking about this themselves. Everywhere people said, a lot of people feel this way. And that's what the email said over and over again. I'm glad you said it because I feel exactly the same way and I can't say it because I'm a secretary at the Catholic school. I mean, most of the mail was positive. It was saying, yeah, I feel the same way. I believe in God. I love him and I want to live a good life, but I just cannot stomach what religion is doing.
Do you have any desire for a public institution, for a church to belong to? Are you comfortable having your faith become a purely private thing?
I am completely comfortable with it now. And many, many people wrote and said, you know, come to our church. We don't teach the things you object to. Or come to our church. We have a gay minister or we have gay people in our church. And those were wonderful, generous offers. But I am quite comfortable alone. I don't feel the need to worship with others. But worshiping with others is, of course, a very important Christian principle. Gathering with others to stand before the Lord. And I respect that. But I don't myself feel the need. I really don't.
You know, throughout history, most religions have come attached to a story, to a set of metaphors and symbols. And you're a novelist. You, more than anybody, knows the power of the imagination. And I'm not sure that you can have a religion that's just a bunch of principles or without having that deeper set of metaphors, those symbols. Where do those come from, then, if we're going to remake it all?
Maybe you don't need a religion. Maybe what you need is to be a good person, is to live according to your conscience, is not to do evil toward other people. Maybe that's what you need. Maybe you don't need those old stories. Maybe that was a phase that we went through as human beings, and it's a phase that has to come to an end.
Anne Rice spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Rice is now back to writing supernatural thrillers. Her new werewolf novel is called The Wolf Gift.
Soon we'll be done. Trouble of the world. Trouble of the world. Trouble of the world.
Anne Rice's defection from the Catholic Church is a perfect example of what Diana Butler Bass calls our post-Christian culture. Bass is a religious scholar with a new book called Christianity After Religion, The End of Church and the Birth of a New Spiritual Awakening. She says organized religion is losing ground fast, even in some of the big evangelical denominations. What's surprising is how many people are abandoning church but not God.
Over the course of the last decade in North America, we have seen the greatest decline in the number of Americans who want to identify with particular religious traditions, with the number of Americans who attend weekly religious services. And this decline is happening across the board. It used to be that when we talked about religious decline, typically we were talking about liberal, mainline, Protestant denominations. But in the last 10 years, the decline has registered in evangelical Protestant denominations. Three of the denominations that are experiencing huge declines right now are the gigantic Southern Baptist Convention, the Presbyterian Church in America, which is the conservative and evangelical alternative to the more liberal mainline Presbyterian Church in the United States of America, and the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church. And those three denominations, all very conservative, long evangelical heritage, and they are showing very substantial membership declines. And
you know what's so hard to understand about this is that we hear so much all the time about America's great religiosity. I mean, the politicians are certainly talking about it. They're calling to evangelical voters. But what you're saying is that America's not really as religious as it was, and maybe not as religious as we say it is.
Well, I think the fine sort of distinction is that America is not as conventionally religious as it was. But, you know, when you look at polls, 91 or 92%, depending upon the polls, of Americans still say they believe in God. But people are unwilling to even refer to it as religiosity any longer. They call it spirituality, or they call it something else, experience.
Yeah.
But they don't want to use the word religion. Religion has, in the last 10 years, been identified in the popular imagination, at least, with something that is negative or hurtful or boring. And people are still spiritual, and they still talk about the Bible. They still care about things related to God and ethics and prayer and religious experience, but they're unwilling to link that with conventional denominations.
A lot of people talk about themselves as spiritual but not religious these days, and I suspect that is a phrase that might resonate with you.
Well, it does resonate in the sense that it's a large group in the United States. It's about 30% of the population who use that identifier. What spiritual but not religious tends to mean is that they are hurt by or weary of traditional constructions of dogma and doctrine, and that they still want to connect with God.
This is something you've experienced yourself, isn't it? You've done a lot of searching of your own spirituality and I guess it's fair to say, of religion.
Yeah, it is. Where I would place myself, though, I'm actually much more part of the 48%. Right now, in the United States, 48% of Americans identify themselves as spiritual and religious. My own life is shaped very much by three religious traditions. That is, I was born and raised a United Methodist, and as a teenager, I joined a rather conservative evangelical church and then went on to an evangelical college and an evangelical seminary. So I know the conservative evangelical world very, very well. As a young adult, though, I became an Episcopalian. I still am an Episcopalian, and I participate in a local parish. I have a daughter who is a teenager, and she was just confirmed last year. But for us, the primary thing that we are concerned about is, do we live lives that have been transformed by an encounter with God? And do we live with passion in order to help with the problems of the world, relieving poverty, making sure those who are oppressed have voice?
Your path is fascinating, but it is also pretty clearly within a tradition, a Christian tradition. And that's interesting in part because there were so many choices in the 70s, and maybe there are now, which may be why a lot of serious religious thinkers look at this spiritual but not religious business and say, pugh, that's cafeteria spirituality. You're jumping from one spiritual fad to the next.
You know, I think in any kind of movement or trend, there's always going to be, you know, the dabblers. And so when I do hear religious leaders criticizing the spiritual but not religious as being kind of theologically lightweight, I'm not going to go there. I do not think that most people leave a faith tradition lightly. And yet we have quite literally millions of Americans right now who are moving around because they have found religion of their childhood unsatisfying.
So what are churches doing wrong or not doing that is sending people wandering away out the door?
It's a combination of things, and a lot of it depends on which religious tradition you're talking about. I think that the mainline churches, like the Methodism of my childhood, they kind of hit the wall a while ago, 30 or 40 years ago. They were almost victims of their own success. They had been hugely successful. So mainline Protestants were complacent when the 70s opened up, and they were thinking that they could just continue to do what they've always had done. For evangelicals, the problem has been the massive identification of religion and politics in their churches. And what has happened over the course of the last decade in particular, and there's many studies and articles, things I could cite about this, evangelicals who are under 30 do not agree with the politics of the religious right. They have different political opinions about gay, lesbian rights and marriage and whether or not gay and lesbian people should be ordained in the ministry. They're very different from older evangelicals. Young evangelicals are deeply committed to environmentalist causes, and their parents are not. Young evangelicals care about world poverty and global issues. Their parents are not interested in those things as political concerns. The only place where younger and older evangelicals agree is around issues of abortion.
But doesn't this mean a kind of overthrow of religious authority? What does it mean for the pastors, for the priests? What does it mean for theories of morality and religious authority?
Well, the turn away from institutions doesn't mean there's a turn away from God or a completely chaotic sense about where all this is going to go. What people are turning towards is lived experience as being the place from which faith should spring. With that shift, it can be threatening to clergy who think that being a clergy person is about being the guardians of an institution. But if clergy understand that their essential call, that their job is not to be a guardian of institution, but instead to be a gatherer of a faith-filled community of exploration, experience, questions, and wonder, well, then there's plenty of space for clergy. A lot of people say that we're actually, this is a reformation or a reformation of Christian faith and faith more generally. You could look at Judaism as going through a similar kind of stress. I think that Islam, as it encounters being a really, truly global religion for the first time and having a lot of adherents in the West, it's going to have to reorient itself around some of these questions, too. And so that, to me, is the Reformation. It's a whole new way of doing things. And I think that it's going to happen. I really am quite convinced of that, actually.
That's religious scholar Diana Butler Bass. Her book is called Christianity After Religion, The End of Church, and the Birth of a New Spiritual Awakening. If religion is dying, how do we find meaning in a secular age? In a minute, we'll talk with the celebrated philosopher Charles Taylor. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Years ago, the renowned Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor wrote an 800-page book called A Secular Age. It immediately became essential reading for any scholar trying to come to grips with the decline of religion. The book has spawned multiple conferences and follow-up books, and Taylor has emerged as a kind of wise man who spent a lifetime reflecting on the struggle to find meaning in a post-religious world. Steve Paulson recently sat down with Charles Taylor for a wide-ranging conversation on everything from Nietzsche's death of God to the disenchantment of the modern world.
Let me invoke the great sociologist Max Weber, whom you've written about at length, that he argued that modern society had lost its sense of living in a magical world. And he made the case that we now live in a disenchanted world. Do you share that assessment?
Yeah, but I think that Weber sometimes slid around in his use of the word. I liked his word, Entzauberung in German, which just means de-magification, right? The end of magic. And that change undoubtedly happened. We no longer in the West feel we live in a world in which there are spirits of the woods that could threaten our cattle or could take us over and so on. The sense of being vulnerable to this is really gone. We really feel we live in a deadened world, which is why some people react by saying it's too dead, you know, we have to re-enchant it, right? Mm-hmm. That has very little to do with religious faith. I mean, except the other way around, that it was certain kinds of religious faith like Reformed Protestantism and Catholicism, which helped to drive out that view of the world as enchanted, right? It was thought to be not properly Christian. Hmm. So the issue of whether we live in an enchanted world and the other issue of whether we believe in God or not have become totally separate from each other. I mean, the idea that rationalistic scientific outlook makes it impossible to believe and so on turns out to be sociologically not really what has been happening.
So if it wasn't because of science that we lost that outlook, what has made the change?
Along with the enchanted world was the idea of living in a meaningful cosmos, a meaningful universe, right, in which there were levels of being and some higher, some lower. So if you get medieval monarchy or early modern monarchy, like in France, the idea was the king is kind of on a higher cosmic plane than everyone else, and therefore there has to be a king, right? Otherwise your society is badly ordered. And we've done away, we moderns in the West have done away almost totally with that, if you like, sacred canopy.
So to get back to this question of enchantment and disenchantment, have we lost something now that the world has become disenchanted, this world of spirits and demons and all of that?
Yeah. I mean, I think we have. Let me point to a very big movement in Western culture, which is based on that idea. The whole Romantic movement in poetry and literature and so on is based on something like that.
Can you explain that? How did the Romantic movement play on this sort of...
Well, the Romantic movement, I mean, it's carried mainly in poetry, so it's not clear ideology. But let's take someone like Wordsworth. Well, he speaks as a great force running through nature and all things, right? Now, it's very, very vague. But the idea is that I respond to nature as something that I have to answer to and have to open myself to in order to have a proper human life.
And then there's a religious sensibility there, isn't there? Even though he wouldn't use
that
language.
Yeah, there's something like a religious or spiritual sensibility there, right. And there's a very strong feeling that if you take the purely technological stance, you know, you walk into this forest and what you see is a lot of lumber that can be cut down and shipped to to China, as against seeing a vast wilderness. Think of Thoreau as an example, right? An American example, right? In wildness is the preservation of the world, I think is a famous line from Thoreau. You see? So it's a completely different stance towards the universe around us. On one hand, purely utilitarian, we're going to cut all this stuff down because we can sell it to the Chinese, etc. On the other hand, here's something we have to respect. We have to try to understand. We have to feel what it's saying to us. The ecological versus the technological, if you like. Yeah. This battle is central to modern Western culture.
But it would seem that the technological side of things has basically won out. I mean, there certainly are the romantics among us today, but in terms of sort of the dominant ethos of society, it would seem to be the more technological that has triumphed.
Yeah, it's won out up to now. I hope we can reverse this up to now in terms of what drives the policies, you know. Now, this is becoming more acute when we look at the actual dangers by something like global warming. So I think we may see a change in our behavior. I hope we will.
Well, let me bring God into the discussion here.
Yeah.
It would seem that a godless world used to be something that caused a huge amount of angst and soul searching. I mean, Nietzsche talked about the death of God, but it also filled him with a certain amount of dread. And the great existential thinkers of the 20th century struggled with the idea of living in a world without ultimate purpose. Nowadays, most atheists don't seem to worry at all about losing God. And I guess the question is, are they missing something?
Well, they probably are missing something, but not necessarily directly God. I mean, to be historical about this, the relevance of God in Christendom before this developed was mainly an issue of salvation or damnation. That is, the issues were seen differently. And the fact that we see the issues so much in terms of meaning is to do with what we've been talking about, disenchantment, more than to do with an issue of God or not God. Because a lot of the romantic poets found a reenchantment that didn't necessarily involve God. But it's the sense of the fragility of that for us that is angst-producing, right? And Nietzsche introduced a kind of very superlative or hyperbolic version of that. He uses God as a kind of symbol. The death of God is the death of what looks like the death of any kind of overarching meaning, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's really what he's using it as a kind of metaphor. The issue is this sense of what's the purpose of my life? I mean, supposing I have the totally technological view and I just want to take this forest in British Columbia and chop it all down and make money with it and so on. Well, to what end? Is getting a lot of money enough to give meaning to my life? That kind of thing.
So isn't this perhaps the great existential question of our own age? Is can you have meaning in a world without God or without some overarching purpose? If meaning is more than just kind of your own private construction of purpose, I mean, if you want meaning in some larger cosmic sense.
Yeah, let me put it this way: without some kind of input from outside, some kind of call from outside, I don't think you can. But it's, I mean, it's an interesting issue we could still vigorously debate. Like we were talking about someone who has this romantic sense of nature as feeling a kind of call from outside. I mean, this woods, this wilderness is kind of calling on me to open and listen and see what it's all about, right? Well, without something of that from outside, I don't think you can develop, let's say, a sustainable, defensible notion of meaning in our lives. And most people do. And most people find history, I mean, they can be, they're very nationalistic, the tradition of their country, or they're committed to continuation of democracy or something beyond simply their own lives.
Now, we were talking about the move that so many people have made in recent years, defining themselves as spiritual but not religious. Does that go back to William James? I mean, we sort of...
Yeah.
He was the one who really celebrated religion as personal experience, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think you could say this, that it's something that was pioneered in the United States first, right? As also were a lot of New Age notions, which you find moving around in people's minds in the turn of the 19th to 20th century, right? And William James was a fantastically powerful articulator of this. His varieties of religious experience is just incredible in the way it gave a structure to this and so on. And he's, you know, it's a wonderful stylist. I mean, the way he can express himself is so great that you go back and look at it again and again and again. It's more than 100 years since he gave those lectures, and they still ring very true.
Have we lost, and when I say we, I guess modern Western society, have we lost a sense of mystery in our lives?
Well, I don't think we've lost it, but I think we all have this sense of mystery. You've got Thoreau back in the Concord and looking in the woods, and he has this very powerful sense. So what we're dealing with is a very widespread phenomenon where people are saying, I mean, I just feel that. You will never stop the human soul from having a sense of mystery.
What does mystery mean to you?
Well, I think that there's a more exact meaning to it than, you know, murder mystery. It means that there is something deeply puzzling, first thing, that is also deeply important. And the third and most important feature, I think, between being puzzling and important beyond that, is that the way to get into it is by, as it were, getting into it, communicating with it, responding to it, rather than the way we do in science. We objectify it, we withdraw from it emotionally, as it were, objectify it, and then try to see how it works, the way you would do with how, you know, your car is broken down, that's how you would fix your car. Mysteries are things that can be, I mean, it's connected to the Greek word for initiation. You have to get initiated into them, as it were, to begin to come to grips with them.
Is this fundamentally a religious act, to get into mystery?
Yeah, I mean, you could call it that, but the problem is that the meaning of the word religion here is so vague. I mean, I could say I'm an atheist, I don't believe there's any God there or anything, but I still have a sense that the world can tell me something, you know? The universe, the wilderness, forest can tell me something, and those people are having a sense of mystery. Now, if you want to say that is religion, okay, but we have to be clear what we mean by religion.
Charles Taylor is a philosopher at McGill University. His books include A Secular Age and the essay collection Dilemmas and Connections. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, go to our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Atheists, Believers, and the Secular. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anstrain Shemps, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, Sarah Nix, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can listen to the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will find shows and interviews available to stream, download, and share with friends.
PRI, Public Radio International.